This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the perils faced by America's favorite agency, the United States Postal Service. The words, "Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night," stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. Those words long associated with the American postal worker.
We will also talk about the $6 trillion bailout. Is it a swindle? Who's going to profit from it? We'll speak with attorney and economist Ellen Brown, who has written three books on this subject.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. During the COVID-19 pandemic, U.S. postal workers have been considered essential workers who continue to perform their jobs. Yet the Postal Service is in imminent danger of shutting down entirely due to lack of funding. A permanent shutdown of this quasi-government agency would leave hundreds of thousands out of work, and it would threaten the privatization of a beloved and venerable institution. The nation relies on the delivery of critical goods and services that mail service allows, including life-saving medications. More than 1 billion prescription drugs were shipped last year alone. And in rural areas, millions of Americans rely on the Postal Service to deliver essential goods. When Donald Trump signed into law a $2 trillion coronavirus emergency spending bill, it allowed the USPS to borrow a mere $10 billion from the Treasury Department. Frederick V. Verlando, president of the National Association of Letter Carriers, called this, quote, woefully inadequate, and said, quote, the administration clearly does not understand the importance of the Postal Service, especially now. Donald Trump has said that the administration will not approve the $10 billion loan if the Postal Service doesn't, quote, take his advice to raise package and shipping rates approximately four times. Postmaster General Megan Brennan recently warned members of the House Oversight Reform Committee that, quote, the sudden drop in mail volumes, our most profitable revenue stream, is steep and may never fully recover. The Postal Service remains the most popular federal agency among the public. In a recent Pew Research poll, more than 91% of respondents said they have a favorable opinion of the USPS. That rating is higher than the CDC or the Census Bureau. Joining us to talk about this dire situation is Chuck Zlatkin. Chuck is the legislative director of the New York Metro Area Postal Union. Chuck, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Chuck, what does a quasi-government agency mean exactly?
Okay, well, it means that Postal Service is part of the government, but it's an independent agency. And in the case of the Postal Service, this was established in 1971. And it was designed to carry out the functions of the post office for the American people, and it would be self-sustaining, that it would raise its revenue from its sales of products and services and not use government funding.
So to what extent has the recent COVID-19 pandemic affected Postal Service funding and income?
It's been devastating, actually, because as people realize the impact on the economy, people aren't receiving as many catalogs and mailings. People aren't, business isn't functioning the way it used to. The volume of the Postal Service is way off, and therefore its funding is way off. And since it supports itself from that funding, it's in a crisis situation now.
Now, I understand that existing post office debt was already steep before the pandemic, about $143 billion in 2018. And there had been, I guess, in the last 13 years, ongoing financial losses. Can you explain the 2006 mandate that the post office pre-fund retired health benefits for its retirees?
Yes, I should be clear that of the reported losses, it depends on who does the study. It's somewhere between 85 and 95% of the losses all stem from the 2006 Postal Accountability Enhancement Act, which mandated that the Postal Service pre-fund future retirees' health benefits 75 years into the future, and to do it within a 10-year window. Now, this was to fully pre-fund retirees' health care benefits. No business, agency, anywhere did they fully pre-fund any kind of retirement or health benefits. And this was created, well, whatever the reasoning was, it was ended up creating a hardship on the Postal Service. That legislation also limited the amount of money that the Postal Service could ever borrow, and it also limited raising prices. It only could do it with the Consumer Price Index. If there was any other reason that the Postal Service needed to raise funds, it was out of luck. And it also prohibited the Postal Service from creating any new kinds of products or services that didn't directly relate to something that had already been done. So it was really three or four pronged attack on the Postal Service to limit it from succeeding.
I understand that in 2018, the U.S. Office of the Inspector General issued a report finding that the Office of Personnel Management was using a method to calculate the postal portion of assets in the civil service retirement system that was extremely unfair to the Postal Service, which seems to be continuing a pattern. Why do you think there has been this unusual requirement that the Postal Service fund 75 years into the future? The rest of government doesn't do that and couldn't do it.
Right. I mean, what it meant for the Postal Service is that every September 30th, they had to write a check to the Treasury for around $5 billion. And they were able to do it for the first few years, no problem. But then with the economic collapse in 2008, it became more and more difficult for them to meet that burden. Well, whatever calls there were to lessen or change it, any kind of legislative action to remove that unfair liability still hasn't worked to this day. But on the 2018 thing having to do with the retirement funds, that goes back to the fact, well, prior to 1971, when it became an independent agency, the Postal Service was the Post Office Department of the government. When it became an independent agency, it then was required to pay into the retirement funding for its workers. And that's where, back in 2010, both the Office of the Inspector General and the Postal Regulatory Commission hired independent auditors to come in and check in what the Postal Service had been paying into the retirement fund, not to the future health plan, but the actual retirement funds. And these independent audits came up, well, there was some disagreement. The one said that they had overpaid by $75 billion. The other one said it was only $50 billion. That's how much the Postal Service had been paying into the Treasury. And there were actions and calls and whatever to have some kind of legislation to at least wipe out the debt that the Postal Service had, whatever, but the forces in Congress were not about to move forward on this. So there has been a concerted effort to attack the Postal Service after some people would say using it as a cash cow for years, now trying to undermine it, because there are forces that would hope to damage the Postal Service because they want to privatize it.
Yes, and we're going to talk more about that in a minute. Can you just go back for a second? I had forgotten that the Postal Service had been a government entity, and then, as you said a few decades ago, went out on its own. Why was that, Chuck?
Well, what happened when it was the Post Office Department in 1970, we refer to it as the Great Postal Strike of 1970, when postal workers, because they were so severely underpaid and treated so poorly, went on a strike that lasted 8 days. From that strike, then President Nixon moved forward to have the Postal Reorganization Act, which took place in 1971, which created the Postal Service as this independent agency, as a means of, you know, modernizing it and moving forward and dealing with the problems that existed. It also enabled the formation of collective bargaining for the workers. And, you know, other than 2008, from 1971 to the present, it's been working. And now we're faced with this economic problem brought about by the COVID pandemic. In a sense, it actually functioned well, because, again, the Postal Service was there to maintain universal service for all people in this country, regardless of where they live and who they are. And the Postal Service delivers to 159 million addresses 6 and sometimes 7 days a week.
Yes, and I also want to talk about the universal service obligation in a minute. Let's just go back to the finances. Trump has recently called the post office a joke, and he's criticized it for handing out packages for Amazon and other internet companies. But as I understand it, by law, the Postal Service cannot subsidize private companies. A federal court asked the Postal Regulatory Commission to rethink the formula it used to determine if the Postal Service's competitive business, package business, generated enough revenue to justify its cost. Can you explain this briefly?
Well, yes. I mean, this was a legal action brought by UPS, United Parcel Service, who was stating that Postal Service may have been using its non-competitive services to supplement its competitive services, like the packages, where they're in the business of competing against the UPS and the FedEx and DHL and other companies. And that was what they were raising, the fact that the Postal Service was being allowed to unfairly charge rates that were less than theirs because they were being subsidized by other aspects of the Postal Service. Again, reading the court case and whatever, it was basically decided that the Postal Regulatory Commission would have to come back and define how they were working out this formula, because it was difficult or unintelligible for people to figure it out. But in a sense, whatever deals that the Postal Service makes with large users like Amazon or whatever, if they get a reduced rate, it's certainly not below cost. And understand, the reason that UPS feels they're being unfairly treated is because the Postal Service doesn't have to make a profit. Well, that's what drives UPS. They have to make a profit. So they're looking for every edge they can. I mean, UPS spends lots of money a year lobbying against the Postal Service, but also UPS, because they don't want to have to deliver to areas that are unprofitable, put millions of packages into the Postal Service for the last mile. So again, we have to take into consideration their motivation, but also it's important that the Postal Regulatory Commission make it clear that anyone can understand, you know, what the pricing is. But the reality is that it's not going to come out with the Postal Services charging less than the cost. That would never happen, and it never did.
The last I heard, and I may be out of date on this, Trump has approved $10 billion with his conditions in assistance to the Postal Service. But the USPS has asked Congress for $75 billion in emergency appropriations and another $25 billion for what they call shovel-ready projects to modernize facilities. On top of that, it's requested $25 billion in a line of credit. Is there any update on what's happening with this?
Okay, well, what happened is that when the first of the stimulus packages came through, that the Postal Service was asking for relief, as was people who understood the crisis that it was under. At that initial time, Trump said that he would veto any bill that had relief for the Postal Service, that what they allowed in that bill was a $10 billion loan that the Postal Service could make, what you referred to. That was passed by both houses of Congress. He signed it into law. Then, after the fact, he, Secretary Treasurer Mnuchin, came out and said that they were not going to allow the Postal Service to borrow that, use that line of credit unless, one, it raised its package prices by 400 to 500%, which again goes back to Trump's animus towards Amazon and Bezos, who also owns the Washington Post, not based on any factual understanding or even how the prices are set or whatever. And in addition to that, Mnuchin wanted to be able to basically take away the powers, or some of the powers, from the Postal Board of Governors and the Postal Regulatory Commission, where he could decide prices, he could decide management and policies, and also be able to deal in a different way with the postal unions. So, in a sense, the $10 billion that was passed and approved and signed for into law, Trump and Mnuchin are saying, no way, we're not giving it to you unless you succumb to these other demands that we're making after the fact. Now, when the current outgoing Postmaster General testified before Congress, the $25 million was the amount of money needed to deal with the loss of brought about by COVID pandemic because of the loss of income. Basically, the idea is to get relief from the government so that the Postal Service can continue through this crisis and still be here, you know, when it's needed, when the crisis passed, as opposed to being strangled by the administration, so hopefully to put it under.
It's incredible that the government is so pro-business right now, to the detriment of social welfare. Chuck, talk briefly about the White House Postal Task Force. How long has that been around, and what is it doing?
Okay, well, again, this was put together last year by Trump, and he headed it up by Mnuchin, again, the Secretary of Treasury. And basically, it was supposed to study what they called the postal system. And they came out with, I guess, a 68-page report that basically lays out the goal of privatizing the Postal Service. That basically the Postal Service needs to be sold to private industry. Now, the Office of Management and Budget, prior to this, prior to the report coming out, they came out with their recommendations to make the Postal Service more palatable to be sold. It would have to reduce cost, and to do that would be reducing service, but also, when they say reducing cost, it meant eliminating a collective bargaining for the wages for the employees, because they were getting paid a living wage, and that's something that is not tolerated by this administration. So basically, it was created by Trump to bring about his desire to privatize the Postal Service, and it was headed up by Mnuchin. Now, originally, when it was put together, it was supposed to come out with their report in September, but they decided to postpone the report, and came out in December, actually, because they're aware of the fact of that they don't want anything negative about the Postal Service coming out around elections, because they understand how dependent people are all in the country, particularly in rural areas, depending upon the Postal Service, and they don't want to put people in jeopardy by running on that part of a platform. And this is part of the reason why the Postal Service gets bipartisan support on all these legislations. Again, the money that went was supposed to go into in the first package, or the one that's in this, that the House just passed last Friday, for the $25 billion, has support from both sides of the aisle in the House and also in the Senate, because they understand how dependent upon the Postal Service their constituents are, and they can't turn their back on it. So basically, that's part of the struggle. So in this most recent stimulus package, the HEROES package, which was H.R. 6800, which was passed in the House and then would go to the Senate, calls for a $25 billion relief for the Postal Service. It also calls for the Postal Service to be able to use their $10 billion loan without strings. It also includes HEROES pay, which includes postal workers getting an increase for the time that they've put their lives in jeopardy. I mean, I should mention that through the pandemic, 1,400 postal workers have been positive with COVID, and 60 have died. So there is the risk that people are taking going out there every day. But so anyway, so now McConnell has said, you know, he's not going to deal with it. Trump has said that this new package, he would veto it or whatever. But now it comes down to the American people, at least in terms of the Postal Service, is, you know, people articulate their desires to keep the Postal Service going and reaching out to their legislators, particularly senators in what we refer to as, you know, red states or purple states or whatever, to let them know how important the Postal Service is to them. And then they'll end up having to decide, well, are we going to serve our constituents and move forward and put pressure on the Postal Service, or are we going to find it politically expedient to capitulate to the president? And I think McConnell will go along the same way. If he hears enough from his senators that their constituents demanding a public postal service may be maintained, they may change their attitude on getting this emergency funding to keep the post office going through this pandemic crisis, so it'll be there to serve the American people, you know, for generations to come. I mean, it's an important part of the economy. Again, the Postal Service delivers 1.2 billion medical prescriptions every year. That prescriptions that keep people alive, keep them sane, keep them from excruciating pain. How will they get this if the Postal Service is stopped from delivering?
Well, I think the answer is they won't get it.
Again, it's incumbent upon people to get involved in this. If they really need to keep the Postal Service going, they have to let their elected representatives know that it's important to them and a priority, because that's what's going to save it. Because what will happen once it's gone? Well, we look at around the world where there is privatized postal service, and what it always means is less service and higher price.
But let's remind listeners that USPS has a universal service obligation to deliver mail to every address in the country 6 days a week. It has a distribution network that, as you've alluded to, no private entity could replace. What is last mile delivery?
Okay, well, last mile delivery is the delivering of mostly packages, but also documents or whatever, where people live or where the businesses are, that the commercial services don't want to deliver to, where it's not profitable. Since everyone's entitled to delivery and it costs money to go out to some rural area or some place that's, you know, not easily accessible, they want the commercial services, UPS, FedEx, DHL, whatever, will use the post office for the last mile. In other words, they'll deliver it so far, and then they'll drop it off and have the post office deliver it. FedEx actually reports the millions of packages that they put into the postal service every year. UPS is quiet about it. They don't want to reveal how much they use the postal service. I guess on one hand, when you're fighting against the service and you want it to be damaged, you don't want to admit to the public that you as a business are also using it. Because a lot of times, you know, you'll be at home, people don't realize something sent to them by UPS or FedEx, and it's delivered to them by the postal service. They're getting that package from the letter carrier because they don't want to use the expense of having to get it to them. So that last mile delivery is basically the completion of the universal service by mandating that everybody gets it, and that these commercial services don't want to do it, so they use the postal service for that last mile.
Chuck, we just have a few minutes remaining. This segment is being recorded on May 20th. How much longer can the USPS as we know it survive?
Well, according to the outgoing postmaster, Megan Brennan, the first postmaster general of the United States, who is a woman and also came out of the Postal Service herself as a career worker, she estimated September. I guess at this point, there's really no way of knowing and how that will actually break down, but it's something that we don't know exactly and don't want to have to face. I mean, the horror of that, what it's going to mean for people, what it's going to mean for seniors and veterans and whatever, to not have that mail delivery, it's just something that we don't want to even have to comprehend. But if she's a decent person and a hardworking person, we didn't always agree with everything she did as Postmaster General, but she was one of the better ones that we've had. If she says September, I don't think that's a scare tactic. I think that's really her best estimate, and that's why it's important for us to get legislation through to at least get the emergency $25 billion to keep the Postal Service going so that it will be there for generations to come.
Chuck, you mentioned the importance of listeners contacting their elected officials. Is there a website or an online organizing presence that listeners can go to?
Yes, nationalruralorganizing.org. They've been actively involved with a petition campaign with Move On. They've collected hundreds of thousands of petitions. People can go to that website. People can go to my national union, which is APWU4letters.org, and there's a form to fill out, or actually phone numbers to call that can easily get through to their senators. There's another organization put together by the unions called USMailIsNotForSale.org. So those are three places that people can go where it's pretty easy to be put in contact with their elected officials. Or I guess they could call the Senate switchboard itself if they feel better about that. But it really is essential for people to contact their legislators, particularly those who live in rural states. If you have friends, relatives, coworkers who live there, you know, let them know what's going on, because this is really, you know, saving the people's post office. This is owned by us. It's not any private entity. And the Postal Service is actually a year older than this country. It would be a shame to lose something that's listed in the Constitution.
What would a shutdown of the Postal Service mean for the ability to vote by mail in the upcoming presidential election this fall?
Well, it would be a disaster for vote by mail. The leading opponent of voting by mail is President Trump. That could be part of his motivation to take out the postal services, because his fear that people will be voting by mail and having the ease and access to vote by mail will hurt his chances or his fellow candidates' chances. But the reality is I don't see how it would function. If there's no postal service, how are people going to receive their ballots? How are they going to mail them? How is it going to be delivered to the various boards of election? It would be a disaster for voting by mail in this election if the Postal Service is shut down, weakened, damaged in any way. It needs to be functioning well so that it can be carried out for the American people, particularly in this era of COVID-19 pandemic. More and more people will be wanting to vote by mail, and they need to have the Postal Service here to be able to do that.
Chuck, this has been a sobering interview. I want to thank you for your efforts on behalf of America's favorite agency. And thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you very much for having me and giving us this opportunity to get the word out, this necessary word out, to the American people to fight for their postal service.
Thank you, Chuck. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
So far, Trump and Congress have authorized $6 trillion to be given out to stem the ongoing depression that we're in. $1 trillion is $1,000 billion, and $1 billion is $1,000 million. There are so many zeros in $6 trillion that the number, when written down, stretches from one side of the page to the other. $6 trillion, if divided up and given to each American worker, would mean that each one of them would have gotten tens of thousands of dollars. But instead, most of the money went to the hedge funds, banks, and big corporations. The average American got very little. Small businesses got very little and are now pressured to open up. State and municipal governments got very little. Millions of people got nothing at all. Under the bailout legislation, money could go to finance public banks. These could be used to finance a better society, particularly a Green New Deal. Public banks could be like a utility, operating on the principle of doing public good. We speak today with attorney and economist Ellen Brown. She has written 13 books on economics and healthcare and is the founder of the Public Banking Institute. We'll be speaking about the COVID-19 bailouts and how they will betray Americans, just as the 2008 stimulus aid betrayed Americans. Ellen Brown is the co-host of a radio program on the Progressive Radio Network, PIRN.FM, called It's Our Money. Attorney Ellen Brown, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
Ellen, when Bernie Sanders was debating and advocating Medicare for All, he was mocked by his Democratic and Republican opponents and asked, where will the money come from? Now, all of a sudden, the money is $6 trillion. The money's there. How do you explain this, and where did the money come from?
The money will come from the Federal Reserve, which is just creating it on its books, just as it did with quantitative easing. What we have argued for before, like universal basic income or Medicare for All, was payouts directly to the people. And so the objection, what the economist said, what the difference was that with quantitative easing, it's really just a loan and it was reversible. So the Federal Reserve bought either mortgage-backed securities or government securities. And then if the prices went up, if it caused inflation in the economy, they could then sell those bonds back into the economy, which would pull money out of the economy and back onto the Fed's books. So it's supposedly reversible. But it wasn't reversible, as we saw when the Federal Reserve tried to sell the bonds back into the market. It it crashed the stock market, and everybody freaked out. And so everybody thought the economy was going to shrink and go down, down, down. So the Fed then bought those same securities back, and they're back where they were. So you really can't reverse it once you start. So whether they put helicopter money out there and fly over the people and drop money on them that they can just put in their pockets and they don't have to repay, or whether they buy bonds that of the government, which is never, we know the government's never going to pay the debt back. There's no way we can pay back $22 trillion in federal debt. What we pay year after year after year is the interest. And if you move those bonds onto the books of the Federal Reserve, they are required to return the interest to the Treasury, to the federal government. So it's basically interest-free borrowing rolled over year after year after year, which means essentially they're just printing the money and giving it to the government. And so that's what they're doing blatantly and outright with this bailout now. But I've argued it's not going to create inflation, or not consumer inflation, any more than quantitative easing did. Where the inflation happened was in the asset market, because that money didn't go into the consumer economy. But the consumer economy needs money. In fact, it needs money year after year after year. And this is because of how our money is created. Contrary to what people believe, most money is not created by the Federal Reserve or the Treasury and printed and put out there. A very small portion of the money supply is actually cash. And the rest is created by banks when they make loans. That's where most of our money supply comes from. So when you go to the bank to take out a loan, they don't borrow that money from somewhere else. Contrary to popular belief, the Bank of England has actually confirmed this now, and so has the Bundesbank and the International Monetary Fund, that when the bank makes a loan, it just writes that money into your account, and then you spend the money, so it goes into another bank, let's say. So the second bank will count that as new deposits coming in, and when they tally up the money supply, they include deposits in the money supply. So that's how the money supply increases. So banks create money, and money is extinguished when the loans are paid off. But what they don't create is the interest. So there is always more money owed back than was created in the original loan. So there's always a gap between the debt, the money owed, and the money available to repay the debt. And that's why debt goes up, up, up. And every 10 years or so, we have some sort of crisis where the debt collapses. People just can't pay that debt anymore. And the whole economy collapses. And the rich who had money buy up the assets cheaply when they're forced to sell, when they're in foreclosure or whatever. And then they rent them back to the people that originally owned them for inflated prices. And that's one of the ways that the rich get richer while the poor get poorer. So it's a bad system. And the way we could equalize all that, what they did thousands of years ago was they had periodic debt jubilees, but that was when, so they just forgive all the debts, tell the debtors, the debtors who are in prison, go back to your farms and farm. We want you to produce. But that was when the lenders were the government, the kings, and the temple. So it was a religious government, and the temple was basically the lender. So they could do that. But now the lenders are private, and you can't just tell the banks and the whatever, the pension funds and all the lenders, you can't just say, write off your debts, because wouldn't be fair to them. So the other alternative is to fill that gap between debt and the money available to repay it with new money year after year. You just put it, and the actual gap is about $1,200 a month per person. So if you get per adult, I guess. So if you gave every adult $1,200 every month, you would fill that gap, and things should equalize without driving up prices.
Well, that leads me to my second question, Ellen. Who influenced $6 trillion? Who influenced where this money would go?
Well, that's another good question.
Thank you.
$2 trillion was in the original CARES bill, which is up to, then went up to close to $3 trillion, and now they're doing a second version, which has passed the House of Representatives. It probably is dead on arrival, it is said, in the Senate. But anyway, they plan to increase that even more. And of that, $1.5 trillion of the original $2 trillion was to go to big companies. And it was only half a trillion would go to the people. And that was negotiated in Congress, but the problem is you've got the big players that just have all this leverage. The bankers, it's been said before, I think Dick Durbin said in 2009, that Wall Street owns Congress, and the lobbyists really kind of call the shots, and the little players might try to get their voices heard, but they're forced to go along with their party in order to get whatever little scraps they can get for the people. And that's the way our faulty system works. And then there's $4.5 trillion in credit that the Fed has said they would make available at cheap rates. That $4.5 trillion, of course, that's going to be doled out by special purpose vehicles that are set up by the Treasury, owned by the Treasury. So we, the people, are going to put up $454 billion to fund these vehicles. That allows them to create 10 times as many loans, just like with a bank. So that's like a shadow bank. So we're on the hook for liabilities, and who will determine who gets the loans is BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, which is clearly an interested party because the first thing they bought were exchange-traded funds, and that's what BlackRock deals in the most, and those were in trouble. So you've got somebody with a clear conflict of interest deciding where these loans will go, but who could stop them? It's just this huge engine that's bought and paid for by big business, and big business gets to feed at the trough first, and the little guys, the little pigs, don't get in there.
So is this an opportunity for Wall Street and the big corporations to swindle the public?
Again, yes, it is, of course.
In the 2008 bailout, there was basically the banks were bailed out. They were supposed to put the money into the real economy, but they didn't do it. What's the situation today with the current bailout? Is that going to get into the economy, or is that going to just, like you say, the rich get rich and the poor get poorer?
Well, it's not going to stimulate the real economy much. I mean, it will make up for the gap, the fact that all these businesses have shut down, and so they don't have any income. And so some of it's going to go to them, their unemployment benefits, et cetera. So it will be better than nothing. But the vast majority will go to the big businesses. Like right now, Walmart is open, and the big merchants are open, and the little merchants are not allowed to open. Why that is, I don't know. But supposedly the big merchants are indispensable and the little merchants are dispensable. But that what's going to happen is that, as happened after 2008, when the big banks just gobbled up the little banks because they couldn't meet those onerous new regulatory requirements that were really there to, because of the faults of the big banks, but the big banks got the benefits. Likewise, you're going to see the big businesses buying up the little businesses because they're going to go out of business, or just buying up the market after the little businesses have gone out of business.
The pandemic has really hurt the economy of the 50 states. How do you explain that Congress has allowed only 5% of the bailout money to go to the states? And why is Mitch McConnell saying that he'd rather have the states go bankrupt?
Well, they think that the argument is that the states are in trouble because of these pension funds that were overpromised back in like 20 years ago when the stock market was doing well, and people thought you could make 10% a year in the stock market, and so they were basing their payouts on that. But the limits they put on the bailout money were that it couldn't be used for anything that was in the budget before March 2020. Well, the states put everything in their budget. That's what they do. They plan to spend X amount for nurses and Y amount for teachers and Z amount for the police or whatever, and they put that in the budget, and then they do spend it. Well, they haven't gotten the income because the businesses are out of business, and they've had to pay a lot more in unemployment benefits than anticipated. So costs are way up and revenues are way down on their regular budget, having nothing to do with the pension funds. I mean, what they could have just done was say, spend it where you need it, but we don't approve of using it for your pension funds. They could have just said that. And, of course, what their real motive is to bankrupt the pension funds and to force them, or to bankrupt the states. Or that's what Mitch McConnell said. He would rather have them declare bankruptcy. The thing is, they're not allowed to declare bankruptcy, but he wanted to change that rule, let them declare bankruptcy, and then they could get rid of their pension obligations. That's what the big airlines did, where they didn't go out. They say they're bankrupt, but that doesn't mean they're going out of business. What it means is we don't want to pay these stewardesses anymore, you know, what we promised them after being on their feet for 40 years and finally retiring. We're not going to pay them their pensions.
So there's no programmatic Democratic Party opposition to Trump. There's hostility, which is not the same thing. Why is the Democratic Party opposition much more rhetorical than real?
Well, you've got big money at the top of both parties. And I've heard it said that they would rather see Trump win and then they can blame him for everything that goes wrong, while Trump is obviously he wants to prop the stock market up, which means big money. That's where big money is. The little companies aren't in the stock market. So big money just wants to do what's going to be good for them, and even made a point of getting in and controlling both parties. So we don't really have... We have a Democratic Party with a progressive wing that's there to that's trying to represent the people, but they just get steamrolled over by big money, and everybody has to have the big companies' support, because the way our system is run, you don't really know these people. All you know is the little advertisements you see on the television or whatever, and so whoever gets the most advertising out there wins, and that's very expensive.
We're speaking with Attorney Ellen Brown, who's also an economist, who's written 13 books on public banking. Ellen, please talk about your work in supporting public banks. What is a public bank? And let's talk about how that might be something that could add to the good that might come out of this catastrophe.
Actually, I've written 3 books on public banking and 10 books on alternative health care, the politics of alternative health care, the politics of the cancer industry, et cetera. That's what got me into banking, when I realized that it was the banks that really controlled everything. And if you wanted to fix the system, you had to fix the banks. So my first book on that subject was called Web of Debt, and it came out in 2007 and went into 5 different editions. After I wrote that, I started writing articles, and after the 2008 crisis, I knew that there was only one state-owned bank, and that was the Bank of North Dakota, and I only knew that. It was very obscure information. It was something I heard from somebody at a money reform conference, but he wasn't a speaker. It was just somebody in the back, you know, who told me that, and I said, oh, that, you know, how interesting. He said, oh, but it's just an ordinary bank. He said, they don't issue their own money, which was what he was thinking they should do, is issue their own money. Bank, you know, that states should be able to issue their own money through their banks. But I knew that, and so I was watching North Dakota, and it turned out that North Dakota was the only state that never went into the red. It had the lowest unemployment rate in the country, the lowest default rate, the lowest foreclosure rate, and the most local banks per capita. It had like 6 times as many local banks as others. So I looked into their business model, and I thought it might have something to do with them doing so well. And of course, China also escaped the credit crisis, and a lot of Asian countries, and they had very strong public banking systems. So public banks lend countercyclically. They lend when the private banks are pulling back from lending, and they have lower cost loans, and they cut out the middlemen, so the profits can be shared with the public and with the economy. So anyway, I started writing about it, and that generated quite a bit of interest, and we formed a Google group and went round and round on the issues for a couple of years, and decided that we were then the experts, and so we got out there and decided it was time to get out there and do something. So we formed the Public Banking Institute, and we've been, right now I think we have 25 active bills across the country of different groups working on getting public banks in their cities or their states. We had that many, like, I think we had 23 or something within 2 years, and we thought, oh, this is easy, we're on a roll. We had a bill that passed both houses of the legislature in California, but Jerry Brown didn't sign it, and that's kind of the way they went. You know, you'd get quite a ways, and then it would die in committee, or it is said that feasibility studies are where bills go to die. Anyway, we came up against all kinds of roadblocks, and now we're on our second wave of bills, and we're more savvy and know what we're up against. In this crisis, it would behoove the states to have their own banks, because instead of having to borrow at bond rates plus a penalty, which is the best that the Fed will give them, and bond rates are going up because the people are dumping their municipal bonds, it would behoove them to have their own banks so they could borrow at 0.225% like banks can. So that's what we're saying.
Ellen, is there money available from the stimulus package to put into such banks?
What you need is a pot of money to capitalize the bank, and then you can lend 10 times that sum in loans. That's the way the rules go, and now they've, since they're being more flexible on that reserve and capital requirements, you can probably lend more than that. Right now, Rashida Tlaib is presenting a bill to get money for capitalization of the banks, to get that passed in Congress, so that you could just have a startup sum, whatever the minimum is in the state, to capitalize a bank. Or there are various pools of money that they could use to capitalize a bank, because it's not like you're spending the money. It's an investment. The Bank of North Dakota has had an average of return, or I think of about 17% over the last 15 years. So it's an excellent investment. You know, it returns year after year after year, even when the state itself was doing poorly, because oil, they're a big oil state, and oil had just plummeted lately. But still, the Bank of North Dakota itself just does record profits year after year, and that's because of their business model. They cut out the middlemen, and therefore they can make below-market loans and still have a really nice return.
Well, let me ask you a big question. We've got about 5 minutes to go on our interview, Ellen, but what I've been wondering is whether public banks could fund a green solution to the impending climate change catastrophe.
Depends on what you mean by, you know, what you would have in your solution, but it could fund all sorts of things. There are all sorts of ways you can get new money into the economy, and we need new money into the real economy. The problem is we have two economies. We have the real consumer economy, which is dying, desperately needs new money pumped into it all sorts of ways. And then we have the financialized economy, which is doing very well, thank you very much. I mean, the billionaires I don't remember the figures, but they've made quite a bit of money in the last few months. Their income is going up, and the stock market, of course, is bouncing right back because it's been propped up by the Federal Reserve and by this bailout money. So problem is that they suck the money out, and they don't spend it back into the consumer economy. That once it goes into your savings, it goes into the stock market, it might just be sitting in cash in a stock market account, for example, the money that you're not trading right now. And companies have trillions of dollars, collectively on their books that they're not spending right now, and they've got it, you know, invested somewhere at some modest interest, but it's, they're not spending it on consumer goods. There's only so many consumer goods that a billionaire can buy, and then the rest of it goes into this other economy where it's money making money, and what they do spend their money on is things like lobbyists and you know, big things to,
exactly,
influence and control. Yeah.
Well, Ellen, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time, but I have one last question for you, if I might. We all know that nothing will ever be normal again, but along with this catastrophe, there seems to be an acceptance of the idea that health care is a human right, that fundamental basic income is also a human right, that education should be free, paying rent is also called into question, the massive military budget is called into question. Please talk about what good you think might come out of this catastrophe.
Yeah, well, it's evident that our system is very bad. I mean, we haven't even managed, supposedly we have the best health system in the world, and we've got the worst rates on this virus. European countries are doing better than we are, and even China has managed to get control of it much faster than we have, and they all have better, cheaper health care. They've got better health, and their health care is cheaper. So there's something wrong with our system, and we could see there's something wrong with our banking system and our distribution system, that the people, right people, aren't getting the money from the bailouts. That we need a lot of reform, and this has definitely focused a bright light on that. And so what I always try to write about is solutions, what we can do to fix things. And there's hope there, anyway.
So how can people follow your work?
My own website is ellenbrown.com, and the Public Banking Institute website is publicbankinginstitute.org. It has a lot of information available, and I have hundreds of articles on my website. And my books are available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, et cetera, Web of Debt, or The Public Bank Solution, or Banking on the People. Those are my three banking books.
And you have a radio show.
Yeah, it's on PRN.FM.
And that's PRN.FM,
yeah.
Ellen Brown, it's been a real pleasure to have you on Law & Disorder. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.